Welcome to Season 5 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we are further expanding our knowledge by speaking to experts in the fields of physiology, psychology, nutrition, strength and conditioning, and mindset training. We will be speaking to the coaches and practitioners who do this every day, and to the researchers and academics who are at the forefront of the latest science. Joining me today is Dr. Nicole McClellan, better known as Dr. Cox. Dr. Cox is a naturopathic doctor, gaining her doctorate from the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine. She also holds a Bachelor's of Applied Human Nutrition with Dietetics from Mount St. Vincent University. Dr. Cox works out of a practice in Nova Scotia on the east coast of Canada, where she works predominantly in sports medicine and pain management. Her interest in total performance optimization and being a former athlete herself has led her down the path of specializing in female athlete physiology. In today's episode, we are going to break down everything you need to know about the menstrual cycle, what is considered normal, potential performance implications during each stage of the cycle, oral contraceptives, and how all of this applies to athletes who have to make weight. This is a hugely informative episode, so let's get to it. All right, that green light means we are live back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. So joining us today, very good friend of mine, Dr. Nicole McClellan. Nicole, did I say that right? McClellan?
You killed it. That was a really good effort.
I actually thought I stuffed that up, to be honest. I thought about it a bit too much. But for everyone who doesn't know, you might know Dr. Nicole better by her name, but there she goes on social media by Dr. Cox or Sport Doc Cox. We definitely do a lot of work together, and what I've got Dr. Cox on today is to talk about female athletes and female physiology, because it's an area that so many people don't have good information about, and it's an area that so many practitioners, including myself, don't quite have all the necessary information. So people like Dr. Cox are very, very important. But before we get started, Dr. Cox, can we just get a little bit of a background on yourself and how you came to be in the position you're in today?
Yeah, definitely. So I started, funny enough, I wanted to be an artist, actually. And my dad was a super smart guy. So he was like, if you go to business school, I will pay for your art program afterwards. And I was like, okay, sweet, free art program. Obviously never made it to art school after that. And then once I finished business, I was kind of like, I don't really want to sit behind a desk. I don't really know what to do with all of this. And I had played, you know, high level athletics my entire life. I played university hockey. And then I was like, how can I still stay involved in the sports world? And I moved to dietetics, which was a pretty cool program, but I kind of ended up finding myself in rehab centers. And I was working with like double leg amputees from diabetes complications with like a 2 liter of pop next to their bed. And I was like, I think I have to see people before they get to this point. So then I went the naturopathic medicine route, and I just, I thought the program was super interesting. It was a toss up between that and med school. And my mom had a very like holistic approach to raising us growing up. And there was some cool stuff that I had seen. So naturopathic medicine was the way to go. And it just kind of gave me, you know, a little bit of a broader way to look at preventative care, I would say, than, you know, meeting people when they're already so far down the line of poor health. And for naturopathic medicine, there was a residency for sports medicine. And so that was awesome. I just kind of got more heavily involved in the sports world, and moving back to Nova Scotia, my whole goal was just sports in any capacity. Back here in Nova Scotia, it's a lot of hockey that we see. But a couple of opportunities kind of arose with, you know, talking with the UFC, and a couple of combat sport athletes were coming in to see me. And I thought, wow, this sport is so cool, right? These guys are like beasts, and everyone's working so hard for that like little extra inch. And I think that's why, like, with working with athletes in general, they're just, what is that little bit that can make them that much better, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're talking a little bit offline. Your practice that you work at, Proactive Health and Performance Center, it's an MDD team, and you guys focused on athletes, is that right?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, like, the bread and butter is always, you know, back pain, weight loss, that sort of stuff. But we definitely have the capabilities and education to hit those high level athletes too. So that's kind of where most of our passion is at. But definitely, you know, everyone asks if they can come there if they're not an athlete. And my basis of that is, if you're trying to get better and like you're really working towards something, then for me, you're an athlete, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I love that definition. So we've got a lot to get through, Dr. Coach. So let's not waste any more time. Let's get straight to it because there's a lot of questions to get through here. But I think a really cool one to start with, and this is a really interesting one, and I think it'll set the pretense for the whole conversation is, like, why is it important? Why is it important that we're talking about this? Why are we having this conversation? Why do we need to run a podcast episode that's focused just for female athletes, the physiology of female athletes?
Mostly, like, there's so much important to it. And, like, when I think back about my career in, like, grade six, we probably had, you know, a half an hour on the female cycle, and that was pretty well it. You know, for most athletes coming through, that's all you get. And, like, any sort of coaches that didn't take additional training, that was it, whatever they learned in, you know, health class, right? So I think, like, there's just so much to it, and there's so much research coming out about it now, and we're just trying to, like, really break down what that all means. So why is this important? How can we apply it to an athlete to actually do something with it? And I find too, just talking about it and having these conversations is super important, because if not, it's all coming from one source, which is great. I'm glad that, you know, female athletes are finally getting some research put in on them. But if it's the same person saying everything about female athletics, or if it's coming from the exact same research paper that we're just making all of these inferences, then we're seriously still missing out on the game, right? So I think it's really important that a lot of people are talking about it, a lot of people are thinking about it, and a lot of people are trying to kind of apply the science into something that's functional for athletes, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll definitely get into what all this means when you are trying to apply it. But let's wind it right back. Let's go right back to page one of all of this. And for the guys at home who don't understand, can you kind of talk to us about and, like, walk us through what a regular menstrual cycle is?
Yeah. So kind of the whole point is to have a baby for females, essentially, which I get it, like, is kind of devastating that it's just that evolutionary concept that's happening. But if we walk through the menstrual cycle, and I'll keep it super basic here because a lot of people don't even know that, which is, which kind of sucks, right? So let's just kind of start from the beginning. Our period is like day one, essentially. It can last anywhere from, on average, 4 to 8 days. And I'll just preface all this by saying, these are averages. This is a scientific paper that took a bunch of averages and put them together. So if you're an outlier, if you fall outside of this, this doesn't necessarily mean that there's something wrong. It just means that, you know, hey, maybe have a conversation about it or ask somebody knowledgeable to see if, you know, this works for you, or if it's functional for your system. So that 4 to 8 days is the period time. That's where we actually bleed. Average blood amounts can be between 5 and 80 mils. That's kind of a confusing thing to say to a lot of people because we don't really know. We're not measuring this out often. But if it feels dysfunctional, it probably is. It's usually what I say to females. Like, if it feels tons, then you should probably ask somebody about it. And that period is the initiation of the follicular phase. So that usually goes to ovulation, which is around day 14. Again, there's so much individualization for this, so kind of take it with a grain of salt. On average, most research papers are banking a cycle on 28 days, but they can vary from like 24 to 38 days as well. So there's not necessarily dysfunction if you're outside of some of these windows. For the follicular phase, yeah, it goes right up to ovulation. Ovulation is the release of the follicle, essentially, and that is initiated by a huge estrogen spike. So I guess try to remember the spikes of hormones, because that's going to be what plays into some of the recommendations for athletes for the most part. So the largest spike in estrogen is actually just before day 14 on average. And then we also get a testosterone spike at that time as well. So the second half of the cycle after day 14 is the luteal phase. And that's where we see higher hormones in general. Progesterone starts to increase. There's another spike in estrogen at that time. And the whole point of this phase of the cycle is to build kind of the corpus luteum, which is what would turn into a baby if it was fertilized, essentially, down the road. So that's usually from day 14 to day 28 on this average cycle. And about halfway through there, about 4 to 7 days before our period again, is where we see a lot of dysfunction or a lot of PMS or premenstrual dysphoric disorder. So that's kind of where the dysfunctional things start to come in to play. Another note on the period would be there's a temperature spike at ovulation as well. So that's just something to be mindful of, kind of as we get through this a little bit more too. So ovulation, there's kind of a window on either side of there that if that egg is fertilized, that's kind of what we're looking at for the rest of the luteal phase to build up that lining.
Yeah, excellent. And you were saying there, Dr. Coates, that, you know, this could be anywhere between 24 to 38 days. Are you encouraging your female athletes to track this to kind of figure out, okay, what is regular for you?
100%. This is probably like, if anyone takes anything out of this conversation, it's like, figure out you, because all of this is so individualized and there's so much variability between the temperature spike and how much it's spiking and where your hormones actually start to rise and how many days this actually lasts and how many days your period actually is. So there's so much individuality in all of this. It's why it's a little bit difficult to make these broad recommendations that I'm starting to see on social media about what to do when. So when we see all of these, like, at day 14, start training this way, what if it doesn't really line up for you? You know, it's super difficult to kind of say these things. And I think really getting a handle on your own cycle and then going to a knowledgeable professional to say, like, okay, this is mine, what should we do about it, is kind of hopefully the way of the future of where this is going, you know?
Yeah. And I want to go into that and I want to talk about, okay, well, if we do try to line this up with training, what can we do? But I want to spend just a little bit of time. Mentioned before, yeah, 24 to 38 days, and there's certain, like, factors that can change this for individuals. What are those factors? What can change the length of a female cycle?
So, like, a heavy training period could change it. Nutrition can change it. Stress can change it. Like, there's so many variables. And sometimes there's just a bunch of variability within a female anyway. So, like, it doesn't always have to line up 100%. And if it doesn't line up 100% all of the time, that doesn't mean there's something wrong. It could just be inherent variability in your body. But yeah, heavy training loads is probably the major one that I see that can change that. And just a note on that too, which I always think is super interesting. Most girls who aren't on any sort of birth control would have to almost do that kind of family planning method or, like, temperature method to figure out when they ovulate. And a lot of young female athletes are coming up to me saying, I don't want to get pregnant, but I know when I ovulate, and I kind of steer clear of, you know, having intercourse around that time. But a heavy training period can shift that one way or the other, or a really stressful time can shift that one way or the other. So I always like to make note of that to say, like, hey, don't always bank on that. And it's probably, you know, if you're really not trying to have a baby, that family planning method is probably not the best way to go, you know?
And can you explain that a bit more, Dr. Coates? The family planning, is that literally taking your temperature? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, so there's a little bit to it. There's a kind of, like, basal body temperature charting that you can take. So every day throughout the cycle, you'd get your temperature. And when that temperature rises, it's usually between 0.2 and 0.4 degrees that we see a change. And that's kind of that ovulatory spike that we start to see. And technically, sperm can live a few days. So we want to kind of, on either side of that spike, steer clear of, you know, having intercourse. But that, yeah, exactly. So with training, that can shift one way or the other. So for female athletes, I really don't recommend that because there's so much variability, you know?
Yeah. So what do you recommend, Dr. Coates? If, say, like, a female athlete comes to you and they go, hey, Dr. Coates, like, I really want to figure this out and I want to understand it. What other methods? Do you use apps? Do you write it down? Like, what's the things? What actually works when you're talking about using this in practice?
Yeah, it's kind of whatever they'll stick to for the most part. The Fit Our Woman app by Orico is great. That's kind of one that I recommend, and it's quite, you know, the user interface is pretty easy to use. There's a lot of kind of apps that can, or little kind of icons that you can present your symptoms with, which is awesome. And then there's learning involved with it too. So they keep putting like different blog posts on so females can learn a little bit more about their cycle. And then literally, like, if it's just a notebook that they'll use, then I'll take that. If they noticed on day, you know, 20, that it's their worst day, their lifts were horrible, and they can't perform at that time, then that's really individual and that's really important to know, right? So some of these apps are wicked, but they also, if you could get more, the more specific you can get, the more information we have to work with and the more we can tailor a treatment plan for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And just before, you did mention birth control. And I guess a lot of athletes, it's very popular. They go on birth control to avoid having a period and to avoid the discomfort that comes when it comes to competing and everything else. How does that all affect it? How is taking oral contraceptives or having IUDs or other types of birth control, how does that affect the whole cycle?
So much. But the biggest thing is, like my tagline in the office most times is like, what would affect your performance more? Having a baby, obviously, right?
Yeah.
So I think I don't think there's like fear mongering around it, but there's a lot of, social media is really kind of negative towards oral contraceptive uses. And I do agree, like there is some performance things that we might take a hit on. There is some nutrient depletion that happens with it. But also like performance wise, yeah, baby would be much worse towards your goals. So I think we have to be really realistic when we're talking to young females, and especially since ideally abstinence if they're working towards something huge, but let's be real, let's have the conversation and not shy away from it, because they need something and there has to be something on the table. So what are their options and what is the best option based on how they're presenting? So my usual go-to is to get a couple weeks average or get a couple months average of what their period's looking like, and then before kind of using oral contraceptive devices, if we have time, to see if there's any underlying issues that we should fix first, because the pill or any sort of oral contraceptive will just put a big band-aid on a lot of symptoms. So I would say if you're using it strictly for birth control, awesome. If you're using it for any other reason, let's have a conversation.
What are those other conditions that it could be used as a band-aid for?
Yeah, super interestingly, medical practitioners actually give the pill when there's no period to bring back a bleed. But technically, when you're on any sort of oral contraceptive, you're not, your brain isn't communicating with your ovaries. So there's no actual, and nothing's happening essentially. There's no ovulation at that time. So it's an anovulatory cycle that happens with birth control pills. And so I always think it's very funny that you would give birth control to bring back a bleed, but it's not actually a real bleed. It's just a withdrawal bleed that's happening. So you're not getting your period on oral contraceptive pills, essentially. So I think that's super important to note. Another thing is all of the PMS symptoms that athletes face or girls can deal with. Technically, the pill will modify the hormones in your system, but it's probably not fixing the reason why you have those issues in the first place. So I can totally understand how a lot of bloating and cramping would impair your ability to perform, but there's so many other ways to go about managing that versus, taking a pill for it.
Yeah, and this might be like a bit of a tough one to answer, but obviously with oral contraceptives, you can get lots of different types of lots of different balances of hormones in there. Have you found that there's one that's better than the other, or one that there's, athletes should definitely steer clear from, or what's your experience with that?
Yeah. So like anything close to mimicking the cycle seems to be a little bit more helpful. The tricky thing is it's so individualized of where a woman's hormones are sitting in the first place. So if she kind of has an estrogen dominant picture, which would be like a lot of breast tenderness, a lot of period diarrhea, a lot of pain and swelling before the period, like quick to anger, quick to frustration. Those seem to be kind of the symptoms that go along with that estrogen dominant picture. And then we add more estrogen to the system. You could see how that might be a little bit more dysfunctional down the road, right? And then for progesterone, technically our body makes progesterone, and in a pill form, it's a synthetic progestin that's being given. So we haven't mimicked the human form of progesterone. It's a synthetic version that we're giving to people. So if all of our kind of hormonal processes are being slowed or shut down with oral contraceptive, and there was a dysfunction to begin with, then that dysfunction didn't really go anywhere, So we have to really modify when we're giving it and what we're giving it for, and have a really good understanding of what works with people's systems. So you could do everything right, do all of the testing, and then give the pill and it be completely dysfunctional too,
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it's a lot. So let's go back and let's talk about this and let's talk about the performance, because obviously, like you said earlier, there's a lot that goes around on social media. There's a lot even coming out in the research, and it's, you know, it's up in the air. One study says this, one study says that. Timing of training. Okay, let's do HIIT training here. Let's do, you know, this type of training here. Can you talk about that? Can you tell us, okay, based on a natural cycle that a female athlete's going through, what are the potential performance implications? Are there certain times in the cycle when they should be doing certain types of training, or where are we at with all that? Can you clear that up for us?
Definitely. So there was a huge paper that just came out talking about this. And then this is where I kind of, you know, take papers with a grain of salt a little bit too. So if an athlete comes in and tells me, you know, the week before their period, they're demolished and they can't train and they feel like shit, then that's what I'm treating, right? I'm not treating, oh, based on the science, you're supposed to feel like this, you know? So I think that is really what we have to take from all of this. So I love that social media is posting about this. I love that we're learning more about it. I love that people are actually have the drive under them to start talking about this and educating trainers and coaches. And I think it's a great place to start. Like, there's a few books out there and there's a few resources that I think could be beneficial for any coach or trainer just trying to get like an initial handle on this. But then whatever your athlete is saying is truth, you know, whatever they come in with, however they're presenting, whatever the dysfunction is, that's what we go after. Not necessarily like, hey, you should do HIIT training at this time because that's always something to try to incorporate and say like, does this feel better? And if so, great. And if it doesn't, then don't. But kind of what we're going off or what we see through the cycle is the change in hormones that would be, you know, impacting any of this. So when we think about nutrition, timing, and like exercise timing, that's just what it is. What feels best for the athlete, but also introducing things that may feel better, essentially. So for estrogen, estrogen's awesome, and it kind of gets beat up on quite often because we see whatever an estrogen dominant picture would look like, and that's a little bit dysfunctional. So as I had mentioned, high estrogens can be that like quick temper, a lot of PMS type symptoms, a lot of dysfunction there. But it's also really important for, you know, all of our ligaments and tendons, and with that estrogen surge, we're pretty strong at that time. So right before ovulation, we have that estrogen surge, and we also have that testosterone boost. So that might be when you feel like you're most powerful, and theoretically, maybe that's when you want to hit PRs or work at, you know, big lifts and stuff like that. If that works out, ideally, maybe that's when a fight is scheduled, but obviously we have no control over that. So again, I think like just keeping in mind, potentially there is something there that, you know, try it, see if it works. If it doesn't, leave it. At that time as well, when we have an estrogen spike, our appetite is quite well regulated. Serotonin and dopamine are high with estrogen, so it's kind of keeping all of those leptin hunger cues in check, and it probably is the best time. You'll probably feel your best at that time. And again, very individualized. Some people may feel horrible at that time. So kind of take it all recommendationally with a grain of salt and really figure out when your surges are and when it feels good for you. Estrogen surges the second half of the cycle as well, in the follicular phase. So we're also going to see increased sodium retention at that time. And if you kind of have a high sodium diet, then we're going to see water retention as well. So for your fighters, that's a huge one. And the biggest thing that I could say for any weight class or weight based athlete, is track your, body composition changes throughout the entire cycle for a few months, at least 3 months. We want to see an average of where things are fluctuating, where you're high, where you're low. So coaches can, and trainers and dietetic professionals can work with those numbers to get those numbers down versus if you're fluctuating all month long, that's really important to know, right? For weigh-in time, we can really tailor in an approach that's going to meet all of your weight fluctuation needs versus just one measurement throughout the month. So that one's a pretty huge one. Progesterone spike actually increases our resting metabolic rate. To what extent, it would vary on individual, and in that temperature increase we see as well. So that temperature increase theoretically would increase the resting metabolic rate. And on average, women can burn up to, you know, 100 to 300 additional calories at that time. But as beautiful as the female system is, our hunger and craving cues are going to go up too. So we're almost mitigating that with you know, the decrease in dopamine and the decrease in serotonin that happens. So we also get a little bit of leptin resistance at that time. So we want more food, essentially, is the summation of that. And we want usually saltier food and junkier food at that time. So that resting metabolic rate could be used as an advantage if we can curb hunger cues as well. So, you know, being super prepared at that time and having the right snacks on hand and post-workout nutrition is huge at that time. So there's, you can kind of see there's a lot of things that we can do to mitigate these things. It's just knowing when it happens for the athlete. Another big thing that happens with that progesterone change is progesterone can bind to the aldosterone receptor. So again, pretty huge for fighters. When progesterone spikes, we probably feel the leanest and at our best. And then we almost get a rebound retention when progesterone starts to decrease again. So that's just before the period, that PMS type symptom. Most of us feel quite bloated and gross at that time. And there is a few things we can do to mitigate that as well. It's just, again, how you're presenting. And the coolest thing about all of this is when you look through the research and you look what all of these hormones are doing, it's a really kind of counteracting balance. So yes, this does this, but also these things start to spike. So it kind of balances things out. And the females, any human's ability to adapt is amazing, right? So given all of this, we didn't know a lot of this for years and years and years, and female athletes still killed it. So I think, yes, this is helpful, but also do you, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point, Hay. And I heard this when I was having a discussion about this the other day. Someone made note, it's like, well, you know, male athletes for years and years and years have been breaking world records, and it's because it's all we study, right? It's only now that all this research is coming out on females. So it's like, yeah, females have been killing it, but how much more can they kill it? And it's like, I don't know, you and I would probably guess in a pretty educated guess that a lot more. Like if we put the exact same amount of effort that we have been for their male counterparts, I would bet my bottom dollar that there's a lot more potential to get it. But let's talk about that. I guess in a pragmatic sense, Dr. Cokes, let's use a fighter. Like we're talking about fighters. The whole podcast is about fighters. Let's say like through a fight camp, if an athlete was tracking this, and I guess I'll ask your personal opinion and we'll look for like the professional opinion. Is this like a game of inches that you're getting when you're doing this? Or is it, you know, are these leaps and bounds that you're making if you're getting these? Or option C, which is always going to come in any type of science, is it completely individual? But what is your feeling? Is it inches or is it leaps and bounds if you can get this right?
Yeah, so again, the famous line, it depends, but it could be leaps and bounds if there's a lot of dysfunction in the athlete. So if they've been training super hard, have hypothalamic amenorrhea in terms of overtrained, didn't eat enough, lost their period. We're also looking on that context, like down the road, without estrogen spikes, we're not going to have, you know, as great bone density. So long-term consequences of some of these things, or that kind of female athlete triad that we spoke of, you know, so many years ago, all of those things are dysfunctional, right? So for that athlete, if they're coming to me without a period, and then we start to see hormone changes with them, cortisol is starting to be released all the time, DHEAs are starting to be released all the time, they're almost looking like they have a polycystic ovarian syndrome. And what that looks like is additional hair growth, like black, thick, coarse hair, inability to lose weight, specifically around the midsection, trouble with any sort of metabolic dysfunction, acne starting to come up, like quick to anger, quick to frustration. So that almost like too much testosterone or too much androgens in the system. Despite for males, testosterone is great. For females, too much of it can be super dysfunctional. So with that athlete presentation, there's so much we can do about that. And we can make them feel 100 times better, you know? The tricky thing with fight camp is it's usually a continuation of food depletion and training really hard, right? So I think like timing of all of this and picking when to pick up an athlete and start adjusting things is huge. And their willingness to participate too is also huge. So most of the female athletes that I've worked at have one track mind. They're stubborn. They want exactly what they want when they want it. And I love that about them. But I think more education needs to come out on this. Like if you run your body into the ground and you overtrain too much and you don't eat enough food, you're going to see dysfunction performance-wise, you know?
This series of the podcast is brought to you by TrainAid. Trainaid is a product that I developed for extremely selfish reasons, to make my athletes better. As you guys are aware, I work with world-renowned City Kickboxing, home of two current UFC world champions and many more contenders on the rise. My job with them is to use the principles of performance nutrition to make sure these athletes are recovering as best as they can to ensure they are getting the most out of themselves in training every single session. Despite all of the great things they do to achieve this, there has always been one area that we've never really nailed: hydration. I noticed how despite training for hours on end and losing significant amounts of fluid, we just weren't getting it back in before the next session later that day. It is well known that dehydration can negatively affect your training quality and how well you recover after your session. That's why I developed Trainaid Hydration Solution, so athletes can have a supplement that is backed by science, made by someone who understands their needs, and skips all of the gimmicky marketing. In short, it was developed to make my athletes better. If you want to find out more, head to www.trainaid.com. That's TRAINADE.com. All right, back to the podcast.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because you absolutely nailed it on the head. It's not just females. Males do it too. Like, males absolutely grind themselves when it comes to fight camp. I think everyone who's ever been involved in the sport who's gone through any type of fight camp preparation, comp preparation, it's very easy to do that, to get fixed in that mindset and just, I want to train. You watch your weight and you just almost get in that animal mindset where you just want to keep going and you want to feel hungry. But I guess, you know, I always say females are such complex creatures and us males are kind of simpletons. It's, yes, we do it ourselves, but the consequences, yes, they're there, but females, it can be career changing. It can literally, for the negative. So can we talk about that, Dr. Coase? You mentioned hypothalamic amenorrhea there. Can you talk about, I guess more overarching before we get into specifics, it's probably going into energy availability and low energy availability and the consequences within REDS. Can you give us your thought on that? And then we'll come back and let's tie all this in together. But can we start combat athletes, low energy availability? We just spoke about it, overtraining, undereating. Can you talk us through why that's so risky?
Definitely. So for overtraining, for the most part, I really like to call it under recovery, because I mean, there's people doing Ironman out there. Our body is capable of like the most amazing things, right? And yes, of course, there's a capacity for training, but I think it's like more attributed to this capacity or bandwidth that we have. So yes, female athlete triad is a thing, and yes, you need nutrition, but I think like modifying nutrition to have low energy availability for a short duration of time, I think we can really recover quite well from that. So being really intentional and working with a professional that, yes, you have to get down to a certain weight and we can modify food that way, but as long as the recovery piece is used appropriately for that. So right after the fight, we really work at, reverse dieting, getting people right back up to a functional caloric intake. I think that's huge. So on top of that too, for training, I think this bandwidth thing comes from so many different inputs. So the social factors around sport, the food factors around sport, the coaching around sport, the perceived stress is also a huge one. So when we look at physiologically what's happening to the system, our brain releases a hormone called gonadotropin releasing hormone that from the hypothalamus goes to the pituitary, and the pituitary releases FSH and LH, so follicular stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone, and they go down to the ovaries to release estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone for a female. There is another hormone called gonadotropin inhibiting hormone, which gets released in response to stress and in response to perceived stress. So I always like to highlight the perceived stress one, because most of us think, well, most of us are tough. You know, most female athletes are pretty tough and we can shake a lot of stuff off, you know? So understanding that despite you being stubborn and have a solid headspace, the physiological response to stress is still happening in your body. So that gonadotropin inhibiting hormone goes up to the hypothalamus and kind of stops or slows that whole progression. So the end result is less FSH, less LH, and then less estrogen, progesterone, testosterone. So that's where we start to see hormonal dysfunction start to happen. So in response to gonadotropin inhibiting hormone, it gets released with poor sleep. It gets released with too much training. It gets released with not enough food. It gets released with you being stressed out about the competition. It gets really, you know what I mean? There's so many factors that go into that release. So it's not just not enough food. It's not just training too much. There's so many things that go into this number. And a thing that I see with a lot of probably male athletes as well, but I particularly work with females both, is like this perceived stress of, you know, pleasing people and trying to be the best at everything. And I totally get it because I was there too. But if you loosen the reins a little bit, your performance is going to skyrocket from it. So just because coach says there's 7 day a week practices, like, let's be really realistic about that. Like, maybe there is 7 days a week because you're there with the team, but two of those days are quite light and four of those days are very specific to what you need to accomplish. And then another day is just, you know, that hard bagger that you need to do, right? So I think like understanding that our body releases that stress response to pretty well everything, unfortunately, is important to know. And then we cannot control their stress response, but we can control our response to the stress response. So if we just get flustered and heated and dysfunctional, and for females we start to get quite teary because that hormonal change starts to happen, this is what's dysfunctional. And I think if we really educate and teach these athletes how to control their breath and how to ask for help or how to say no when they know that they're at their own capacity. And the most difficult thing about that is like the difference between being lazy versus over pushing things or overreaching for things. And I think for most athletes, any good coach would know when that's happening, right? So having those really honest conversations with your athletes to say like, hey, what's up? Hey, you're not doing your best right now. Like, what's going on, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I do know because I've gone through it all, and I'm sure you have as well. And this is something I've discussed with lots of other researchers, lots of other people who do this with athletes, particularly females. And when we talk about energy availability, you're given these guidelines, and they're great guidelines, don't get me wrong. But when it comes to making weight in combat sports, it's a whole nother beast. It's a whole nother beast. And I think if you don't do this on the ground with athletes, if you don't understand the type of training they have to do, the external stresses that come with this entire process from so many different angles, I don't think you quite understand it. And Dr. Carl is now releasing good work that, yes, female athletes go in this extreme LEA for an acute period of time. But if you can effectively control these measures and you can control the periodization and the recovery and have a very structured post-camp phase where you recover that energy balance and come back out, you can mitigate a lot of these effects. Is that kind of where your thinking is at, Dr. Cokes, or what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, that's 100% my headspace. Like, think about like history, our body's ability to adapt over time is unbelievable, right? And I think as long as you're working with very educated professionals and they know what they're doing and they're staying within like safety guidelines of things, and it's a little bit tricky because technically there's no safety guidelines that have been kind of developed for weight-based athletes, but like, if you're okay with me saying, reach out to you. You've done this a million times, right? And I think like you're a fairly open book with a lot of this stuff. And I'm certainly an open book if people have questions about what's safe and what's not safe. And always checking in with the athlete is another huge piece of this, which I think you do so well. Like, most of your posts are, you know, right there with them in every heat of the battle. So I think, yes, our body's ability to adapt is massive. And I think, yes, low energy availability for a long duration of time is dysfunctional. But if you do it right and you recover appropriately, I don't think it's going to be long-term detrimental as long as it's really done appropriately, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a really important point to make, right? Because I think when you talk about this and you say it, I think it can trigger a lot of people. And like, yes, obviously chronic low energy availability is never, ever a good thing. But I think seeing it, like you see it all the time, I see it all the time, you go through that with athletes, sometimes you just have to go there. You have to go there to make this weight. And that some athletes, and ideally you wouldn't have to. Ideally, in an ideal world, you could have a lot higher calories, but for certain people's bodies, you just can't. You have to go in that area. And it's all of these things. Can you talk about all the other things other than nutrition? You mentioned the real and perceived stress, the sleep, everything else, the stress management. What are some of those things? What are, in practice, what are some of those things you're recommending them doing? Like, yes, you can get your nutrition right and make sure you get your carbs in after training and yada, yada, yada. But what are all those other things? What are you doing in practice?
Yeah, so sleep is probably more important to me than anything else in the world. And everyone is the worst sleeper ever. So I find that super interesting. Wearable tech, I don't believe is quite there yet to be able to say like with 100% certainty, you know, the hours of REM that you're getting or anything like that. And I think if you know what a good night's sleep feels like, you'll know, right? So I think doing everything to prepare. So what we're trying to do is mitigate a cortisol spike before bed is the goal. And then have a functional cortisol spike, that cortisol awakening response, to be at a good time in the morning. So things that I work on to help athletes with this is before bed has to be, and I'm sure you've all heard this before, but like literally bore yourself to sleep. Like no phones, nothing that's stimulating at all. And one thing I often find too is most people watch, you know, their favorite show just before bed, or they'll eat like their favorite snack just before bed. And that snack usually tends to be a little bit higher carbs. So you can almost have like an insulin, a relative insulin response throughout the night from that. And that can almost look like night sweats. That can like spike cortisol as well. So you might notice in the middle of the night after eating too close to bed that you're, you know, you shoot awake. So that's one thing. The snack before bed is a huge one. So I would say like pair the protein, pair some fat with it so you're not getting a dip in blood sugar. The other thing is screens release that cortisol response. So we want to be as far away from computer screens, or really invest if you have to in like some blue light blocking glasses or things that are going to mitigate that blue light that's entering your eyes before bed. Another thing too is like a really clean, comfortable environment. Like invest in the pillow, invest in the bed, invest in the weighted blanket, anything that like is functional for you, do it, because anything that contributes to a more restful night's sleep is going to be beneficial in the long run to performance. So yeah, there's probably like a million tips and tricks, and what works for you is going to be different than what works for me, but just like start exploring those a little bit. And yeah, the television thing that I was talking about, most people watch their favorite show, which is like, I don't know what people are watching these days, but it's usually like a cliffhanger on Netflix or something that's going to evoke that cortisol response too. Like I know when I finish a show, I'm like, what happened? Like I got to watch another one, you know? So even those little spikes are probably enough to like disrupt melatonin, to disrupt your body's ability to fall asleep. So just kind of being mindful of that. And even like a good thriller book would probably do that too. So I want you reading like ancient Greek history without any of the battles, like just something that is going to bore you to sleep. Another thing is some good breath work before bed. I get most of my athletes on a pretty good breath work routine. And again, what works for one is different than what works. Some people are trying these Wim Hof breaths, but that's extremely cortisol inducing, right? For a lot of people. So that puts us into that fight or flight state as well. So right before bed is not the time to do really intense breath work either. It's more of like a relaxation thing that we're looking for. First thing in the morning, what I often find for a lot of heavily trained athletes is they're waking up as if it's time to start their day at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And that's that cortisol awakening response happening too early. So in that respect, sometimes I use melatonin to push that a little bit. So most people are taking melatonin before bed, whereas I use it quite intentionally right when they wake up, because we're trying to suppress that cortisol response right at that time, not necessarily all night long. You know, if they can fall asleep okay, then they probably don't need melatonin before bed. But if that 2 a.m. spike happens, that's when they need it, I would say. That is a personal opinion, by the way. And then first thing in the morning, we really want to foster that cortisol awakening response. So if they wake up at 7 and feel like a little bit groggy, you just want to flood your eyes with some bright light. As soon as possible, get up, move the body a little bit first thing in the morning. And that's to just foster that cortisol awakening response. So we want you to be alert at that time. And just really training and teaching the body that night after night is huge. Our body loves consistency, and especially our circadian rhythm is obsessed with it. So anything that you can do consistently, like same sleep time, same wake time, even on the weekends, like keep things as standardized as possible.
Yeah, sure. That's super comprehensive, hey, and it's super useful. I think that's a great overview. Like that's a lot of information, but I want to kind of bring it back into the world of pragmatism, and let's talk about this in the process of making weight. And let's go through, say, an athlete They've tracked their cycle. They've done everything they can. They're putting all the practices you just said into place. They're doing everything right. What could they almost expect going through this cycle, say leading up in the week, say they're making weight? What changes in their weight can they expect on, say, over the 4 week or 28 day process or however long it is? What can they expect, and what can be normal? Are there days in their training when, okay, you will feel more fatigued, or, okay, yes, you're going to increase your water retention here and you'll put on weight and you'll have these fluctuations? Can you walk us through, like, practically, okay, this is an athlete doing all this. What can they expect during this process? What's considered normal?
Yeah, so if they're nailing all of these practices and feel quite good, there shouldn't be too much. Like, a period might have a little bit of light cramping, a little bit of PMS. Like, when we think about PMS, it's a premenstrual syndrome, so it's a dysfunctional thing. Like, it's a diagnosis, right? Where it's so common between athletes that we just assume that everyone has it, you know? So there really shouldn't be too much that's happening. Some light cramping is probably it, maybe a little bit of fluctuation in water retention at that time. And like some good diuretics might be used at that time to mitigate that a little bit. And an average over time is going to be huge to determine specifically what's happening for that athlete. During the actual bleed, maybe the first day might be a little bit painful. It shouldn't be anything drastic. Pain is so subjective though, so it's really difficult to say, you know, what pain would be from one athlete versus another. At ovulation, we sometimes notice like a huge boost in energy, probably because of that estrogen testosterone spike. So maybe if that's the time you want to maximize lifts or something like that, that would be it. But again, for some people, it might happen 2 days later and that's your day, right? So I think there shouldn't be anything drastic. It should be pretty, you know, copacetic throughout the month. You shouldn't have huge fluctuations in mood. You shouldn't have huge fluctuations in pain or inflammation. As estrogen goes down, estrogen does really help mitigate inflammation. So that's usually when we start to see those PMS type of pain signals. And like some really good magnesium or really good fish oil is going to help to mitigate a lot of that pain as well. The biggest issue that I have with female athletes is usually finding supplements that meet their needs. So that functional medicine realm really hasn't melded with the sports realm yet. And I am just waiting for the day, essentially. So I think there's tons of things we can do that are very gentle and very safe up our sleeve. But for people out there, you know, treating these athletes, we have to be so mindful of, you know, water restrictions and safe supplementation as well. So yeah, there's some really gentle techniques that we have, but it really shouldn't be crazy. You know, it should just be pretty functional throughout the month. And that last paper said there might be a little bit of a performance advantage in the, I think it was late luteal phase that they said. So, I mean, check it out. Great. If not, maybe another day is your day, you know?
Can you let us know? Is this insider knowledge, or can you let us know what these supplement protocols for, if there's any female athletes that are listening, what do you recommend and when do you recommend them?
Yeah, definitely. So another huge thing with female athletes, and I recommend everyone in the game to do this and every practitioner to be aware of this, is your psoas, the iliopsoas muscle, and any sort of those hip flexor muscles almost mimic period pain, right? So if that period cramping happens, it's because it's swollen there, and that's the whole inflammatory type cascade that's happening. If you combine that with super tight hip flexors and psoas muscles, then you're going to get even more pain. So one of my huge tips and tricks for menstrual cramping is to get your psoas released. It's really difficult to manually do that. So any practitioner that can do deep acupuncture, that really works really, really well for. And then that continual working on it throughout the month too. So it's not a one and done. And especially for, you know, a lot of your athletes, they're using those hip flexors pretty much all day, every day. And if they're not being treated accordingly, then that's just going to contribute to more pain. That 5 day PMS kind of part of things, we want to mitigate as much inflammation as possible. So the goal would be to, you know, get your fish oils in at that time. Curcumin is another really, really good one for that anti-inflammatory aspect. Curcumin is a fat-soluble interventions. So we want to make sure that it's an appropriate type of curcumin, and it's probably not like the run-of-the-mill brand that you would find at the grocery store that's actually going to be functional for you. And that's kind of, again, that safe supplementation and functional supplementation. Like, dosages are huge, timing is huge. So be wary of all of that too. Don't just kind of pull stuff off the shelf and say like, hey, try this, you know. Another big one is that magnesium to release the tight muscles around that time. So that's kind of usually my protocol leading up to a period if there is a lot of cramping and pain. Throughout the month, Vitex is a herb that actually helps regulate progesterone and estrogen balance quite a bit. Again, there's no product that I know of out there that's NSF certified or sports certified yet. There's a company coming out with one soon and I cannot wait for it. So I think as this research starts to progress and as we learn more about the female cycle and more research comes out, I think that gap between functional medicine and sports is really going to start to meld, because there's a lot of great things out there. We just have to be safe with it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's some great recommendations there. I do want to pick your brains though, Dr. Cokes, and this is a term that I really don't like using, but weight cutting. And let's talk about this, and let's talk about, you know, it's a stressful time for a lot of athletes in general, not just females, but particularly for females. If it happens to fall on the time that they're having their period, and you see a lot of them will see this water retention and all the other symptoms that come. Is there anything that you're doing to be mindful of this? Are you planning this during their camp? Okay, when we get to the weight cut, you know, we want it to fall on this day, or what are you doing to plan for that? And what are the signs and symptoms? What can they expect and what can they do to help mitigate it?
Definitely. So that average of what's happening is huge here. And you knowing that as a practitioner is massive. So if the worst case scenario is we're dropping that additional, or we have to account for that body water change, that's something that we should be accounting for from the very start in terms of the weight cut, right? All the way down. And probably based on worst case scenarios, you know? So if technically it's, I don't know, 2 additional pounds of water, that can be huge, right? So knowing that, then we modify food for it, we modify that fight camp week for it, we modify training for that as well. And my best guess would probably be assume it's going to be the worst case scenario. That's usually just what I do. And then if we know things are falling, so fights can come out of nowhere sometimes, and sometimes we don't always have time for that. So in that respect, like, there's a couple water cut techniques, which you probably have all of those at. I think the main thing is just accounting for it in advance as well. Another thing too, we destroy periods. We make them horrible. We make them sound like hell. And even like the words that we use to describe a period is extremely negative connotation in a female's mind. So they dread it, right? Which initiates that perceived stress response as well. So if we can kind of look at a little bit more at like fostering that or encouraging athletes that, hey, don't worry, it's accounted for. We've accounted for this all the way through. And seeing it almost as like, you know, an advantage, the fact that you're still getting it means we're getting these hormonal fluctuations, which is a good thing. And we can optimize a little bit of performance with that as well. And then for the athletes that we just can't manage, again, you had mentioned it before, like for athletes, we're not necessarily looking at longevity. We're looking at performance optimization. And as long as there's extremely clear consent and the athlete has a lot of informed consent about what you're saying and what you're doing and why you're doing it, I think we can, you know, have a little bit of leeway there. And again, very touchy thing to talk about. It's going to be extremely individualized in that respect. But as long as the athlete totally understands the consequences of their actions and they're okay to go ahead with it, I would prefer them to work with me in that respect, because at least I'm going to do it as safe as possible, right? So I think there's a little bit of conversation around that that has to happen. And sometimes that looks like birth control. If the athlete just cannot respond, maybe we have to take the hormones out of the equation. You know, if their goal is to make it to the UFC and they can never get to where they need to be, then we have to do something about that, right?
So what would be the situation where you wanted, or would you would suggest taking birth control? Is that if they had these really bad PMSs and despite doing everything else and putting out best efforts and putting all these other practices into place, they were still there, or they were getting really bad bloating or water retention around the weight cut or whatever. Is that the type of situation where you would say, okay, maybe birth control is more appropriate here?
Definitely. And the tricky thing with that is you could start birth control and make it all worse too. So I think practitioners, like, again, it's that informed consent. It's a huge conversation you have with the athletes. Like, this could potentially make everything worse. Like, do you understand that? Are you okay with that? Or it could be, you know, your go-to for the next 2 years while you're really trying to do this focused task, right? And then we come off, we, you know, help the system get rid of all of the excess estrogens and all that sort of stuff that could be in the system and move on from there. So like, again, like the low energy availability, it's something that we're working with and being really mindful that, hey, this probably isn't the best thing for the body, but like in this scenario, it might be our only option, you know?
This is going to be my next question for you is, in that post-camp phase, when you're coming out of, say, that LEA period or this period of dysfunction or whatever it is, what are you recommending these guys doing to come back out to re-regulate everything?
Yeah, so like nothing drastic, you know what I mean? Just very well-controlled nutrition recommendations to slowly build up that caloric intake, almost that like reverse approach. Again, it'll depend on when their next fight is. It's going to depend on, you know, where they're sitting or how dysfunctional they actually seem after the fight. Hydration protocols are everything at this respect, like refueling the brain with really good fats, refueling. There's a couple supplements that, like, again, athlete dependent, that you could use to just build their system back up a little bit. One last note too, for that fight camp week, when you're talking about like doing everything possible to manage that athlete, I really believe like having them have some sort of control over that autonomic nervous system is super important. So things don't escalate to the point where it's like fear-based responses versus like a well-controlled answer to something. And when they're at that stage of like complete, you know, red zone, but like not gonna die red zone, you know what I mean? If they had practiced this like breath work routine, or if they had practiced this some sort of like meditative technique that they can really hone in and control their nervous system as much as possible, it's really going to attribute to their body's ability to withstand all of this. So when you're talking about like in the desert, if you were able to control that stress response or control your response to the stress response a little bit more, you could see how much that would serve you. And in a fight time too, I often like explain that fight or flight response. If you could use your peripheral vision during a fight and see everything that's happening around you and land the punch exactly where you wanted to land the punch versus just punching because you're nervous and scared and like this is a huge situation, you'd be such a better athlete, right? So I think all of these things that would contribute to helping the autonomic nervous system or helping some sort of control over that, which sounds hilarious because it's your autonomic nervous system, but through research now we can see that breath work, you can hone in to be able to control some of that response. So as long as the athlete has some tools and autonomy over that, I think that that's huge during fight camp week as well.
Especially in a sport like mixed martial arts or any combat sport where you have the stresses like a fight week where you're making weight for, you know, 6 to 8 weeks and then you've got that fight week, that mental preparation. And that's definitely something we've seen with a lot of my high level guys. It's like they're all doing it and they're seeing the results. And yeah, absolutely. I could not agree more. Dr. Coates, I think we're pretty much getting to covering pretty much everything. I guess one last question I want to ask you before I let you go. Practitioners, this is an area, it's almost a tough area to navigate because of not the lack of research, but the confounding research. And it's like, well, this says this and this says that. And like, well, what do I do when I've got this human being sitting in front of me that wants help? So how do I reconcile this? What are your top tips? What are your top tips for practitioners who want to help the athlete, the female athlete that's sitting in front of them? They don't quite know what to do. Can you tell us practical tips and then where they can go to find out more?
Definitely. So I think like step one for practitioners would be learn the physiology, like as best to your possible, like try to understand what potentially could be happening. And then when the athlete sitting in front of you, like hear their story, take the time to listen, ask uncomfortable questions, and like really get in there with them, because the more you know, the more you can help. I think really asking the athlete to track as much as possible in any respect is going to be huge. And I think like the next wave may be this sports psychology coming into play quite a lot with these athletes. And from my experience and what I see, it's really this like perceived stress response that can send us over the edge. So having some sort of tips and tricks that in terms of like being able to control that nervous system is going to be huge. If you have the referral out for sports psychology, like usually what we find at the end of the day is these female athletes, and trust me, I've been there as well, this underlying sensation of not being good enough. You'll do everything in your capacity to overextend yourself because of this inherent feeling of not being good enough. And this headspace around nothing that you do is ever good enough. So a coach coaching these athletes, being mindful of that wording and being mindful of how most female athletes' headspace work, is super important. And they're also coming out now with like some tips and tricks to coach specifically a female athlete. I know we use like a lot of long-term planning and short-term planning when we're making decisions as females. So, you know, being able to incorporate some of those things and treating this athlete not necessarily different than the males, and don't baby them, and don't treat the period as some sort of dysfunction or some sort of thing you have to work with. It's like an advantage, if anything, you know, if you use it correctly and if you use the right terminology around it. I think like promoting women and building this up and not looking at it as like a barrier to success is going to be huge. And out there too, like females are not fragile, you know, don't treat them like that. And they're so powerful. And if you potentially could see all of the underlying things that are going through an athlete's mind while they're trying to train and overcoming this sensation of never being good enough, it's pretty impressive actually what they can accomplish. So, you know, fostering those relationships is huge, and understanding how your athlete responds to things. So it's super cheesy, but that book, I think it's like the 5 love languages or something like that, I found it super helpful for people, because if I'm speaking at you day in and day out, but you're not picking up anything that I'm saying, that's completely dysfunctional, right? And most athletes will just shake their head and say like, yep, yeah, I got it, yep, and then go home and be completely wrote off, you know? So all of this is playing into their headspace too. So these love languages, I just call them like coaching languages essentially. So if you really respond when I give you praise and that's how we build you up, then that's really important to know. If you really respond when I come to the gym early and set up a new tool for you to use and that's what gets you going, then really good to know, you know? So there's a few different languages, and figuring out how your athlete responds to things is massive for their success.
Brilliant. That's an excellent response. So Dr. Kokes, I won't hold you up any longer. Thank you so much for that. That's a super informative episode. I'm sure we're going to do a lot more. I'm sure I'll get you back on very soon and we'll chat all sorts of things. And I really want to touch on that concussion. I might even get Dan, my physio, who's a bit of a concussion nerd as well, to come on, because he'll be able to hold a much better conversation than me in that area. But Dr. Kokes, say people are listening, they go, holy smokes, like I need to talk to Dr. Kokes. I need to follow her. I need to see her work. I need to have all of her socials and look at them every day. What's the best way for people to reach out?
Yeah, I would say Instagram is probably where I post most stuff. It's taken me like 3 years to build a website. I'm still not really there yet. So we'll stick with Instagram for now. And it's at sportsdoccokes. So SportsDoccokes.
And I know it's Nova Scotia. Hey, are you in Nova Scotia? Nova Scotia. Yeah. If there are athletes, I don't even know if there's many athletes in Nova Scotia, but if there are athletes up in that part of the world and they want to come find you, where can they come find you? How can they get on to you?
Definitely. So if people know Nova Scotia, I'm in Burnside at Proactive Health and Performance Center. And yeah, just reach out on Instagram and we'll get you going if you need to come in and see me. There's a couple stipulations around my regulatory body of treating outside of Nova Scotia. So, you know, those conversations can be made, or also I can refer you to somebody in your area as well.
Excellent. I only make Canadian jokes because I did live in that great land for years and I did get out to Nova Scotia quite a lot, and it makes me miss it every single time I think about it. But anyway, Dr. Kokes, yeah, I would. Trust me, I would. I absolutely would if we could. But Dr. Kokes, thanks so much for taking the time. I know I had to get you up early, but that was super informative. But yeah, let's do it again very, very soon. Thanks for coming on.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, bud.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Since research is rapidly developing in the area of female athlete physiology, it's never been more important to stay up to date with the latest findings to ensure our female athletes are getting the most out of their training and recovery. I encourage you to follow Dr. Coates on socials to stay up to date with the latest information in this space. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.